right, I'm set up and rolling, by the way. I should have.
I, too, am rolling. Test one, test two.
We're not rolling. There's nothing to roll anymore. Those days are gone.
It's just rolling fatty smoking blunts. Who smokes the blunts? We smoke
the blunts. It's just a cosmic void filled with tiny magnetic molecules that toggle from up to down. There's no tape. There's no rolling.
That's true.
We have no names, man. No names. Your name goes through like 17 computer systems a day, man. Remember that? Remember that?
Only 17?
When Emmanuel Serial Killer Goldstein said your name goes through 17 computer systems a day in the movie Hackers, and people were like, man, that's a lot.
It is not.
This is the episode about the movie where they hold two mirrors up to each other. 3, 2, 1.
Are we going to have this conversation again in 2 minutes?
I guess we could. I was just going to say, like, someday we have to do a movie with Steven Seagal in it. Maybe.
No, we don't.
Maybe the one where he's not the main focus. We have to in some way invoke Steven Seagal so that we can thoroughly make fun of his number zero, never a hit strut.
Okay.
Because goddamn it, may be the worst thing ever recorded.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Nighthawks Podcast. We are a cinema-centric podcast for folks who like to stay up late. And in the conceptual Nighthawks Diner, we have two gentlemen who like to stay up late, and they do so while talking about movies in a conceptual diner atmosphere. I, myself, am Trevor T. Trujillo, and with me, as always...
Is Matt Theodore? No, Foster, not Theodore Logan. Yes, my alarm is still stuck on the Bill and Ted episode.
This is turning into a several episode arc for you.
I'm afraid it is the forever arc, an arc of the covenant, if you will.
Check out our episode on Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Fortunately, that covenant is simply be excellent to each other.
Well, today we're going to be covering a film that we're betting not a lot of our listeners have seen. Maybe you have. Maybe you have. And if you have, welcome. If you haven't, also welcome. This is a movie that is actually on several streaming sites, including the free ones. We would like to see if we can turn some folks on to this movie. It might be a movie you might not have otherwise watched. And if that is the case, we are going to be deploying our signature spoiler curtain for this episode as best we can. This is a movie that, by its very nature, somewhat spoils itself in certain places, but also uses that to build some tension. Anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself. The construction of this movie is fairly important and is kind of the what you're paying your admission price to see. But we're going to be talking about Beyond the Infinite 2 minutes, which is the American title for this Japanese-produced, Japanese-language film. And it's one that we caught during pandemic, during a virtual film festival. I believe it was Fantastic Fest. Do you remember, Matt, if this was Fantastic Fest, or was this Chattanooga, or Telluride? We did a lot of virtual festivals when we were under the long march of 2020.
Yeah, that was during the absolutely over, don't question it pandemic.
But with that little warning in there, I think we'll get underway. As far as the podcast goes, be sure to, if you're liking this this particular episode, if you like us, be sure to catch us on Amazon Music, on Audible, Deezer, Podomatic, Apple Podcast, Podcast Addict, Spotify, TuneIn, iHeartRadio, and if there is a podcast aggregator that we are not on that you prefer, let us know. Nighthawks Podcast is our Facebook page. Reach out. Let us know. Let us know what you think. Maybe not even about the show. Maybe just tell us what you're thinking about that day. Remember when that used to be what Facebook was for? They started you with the writing prompt of like, what's going on with you? What is going on with you? What's on your mind? Let us know. We are the new Facebook, so long as you can find us on Facebook.
You really want to know what's on my mind, man? Time is a flat circle, man. Observe this model I've made from a Lone Star beer can, man.
I like how you're using the Jim Brewer voice, but you're quoting Matthew McConaughey from True Detective.
Yeah, same guy, really. Just taking different paths, you know? When Matthew McConaughey was like, why don't I stay sane and have a career? Jim Brewer was like, nope.
I don't know. Matthew McConaughey might actually smoke more weed than Jim Brewer. I don't know how many chips I would put on that particular roulette square, but I would put a few.
Jim Brewer has lost his fucking mind is the problem with Jim Brewer.
Oh, I haven't kept up with Jim Brewer. Did he take a drink from the dark
side?
In that
case, nothing happened. He's fine. Just never Google him again.
Well, speaking of things that happen predictably, which is not a dig, it is germane to the conversation. By way of synopsis for Beyond the Infinite 2 minutes.
いじってくん。うちは持って見に行きますよ。マスターって書いてあるやつ。おい。こっちこっち。モニターの方。よ。俺なんだけど。お。俺は未来の俺なんだって。2分後の俺なんだって。
俺に話しかけてる?お前に話しかけてる。その部屋のモニターと2分の時差で繋がってるらしいのよ。こっちこっち。モニターの方。よ。タイムテレビ的なやつじゃないですか?過去ってこと?全然わかんない。未来がわかるんです。行ってきます。パラドックス起きちゃうから。起きてもいいですよ。入れ子構造っていうか、ドロステ効果っていうか、
僕が現在の僕で、僕が2分後の僕で、僕が4分後の僕。
We're looking at a debut film from director, editor, cinematographer Junta Yamaguchi and written by Makoto Ueda. In this film, a cafe owner by the name of Kato discovers one day, seemingly at random, that a computer monitor in his apartment shows what's going to happen in the cafe where he works below his apartment. 2 minutes into the future, as the strange occurrence is revealed to Kato's friends and co-workers, the monitor from the apartment that shows 2 minutes into the future is made to look at a monitor that shows everything 2 minutes in the past, creating a time loop of sorts. Specifically, they invoke it under its name, the Drost effect, the infinite images when you put up two mirrors together. And this allows our characters to see beyond 2 minutes. But when you open infinity like that, things might get a little crazy. Presented as a film done in one take, Beyond the Infinite 2 minutes is crazy, it's original, it's well-written, it is tightly timed, which is important for a time loop movie. That's going to leave, it left me wondering what if, and I hope it will leave our audiences out there asking that same question.
Hello, welcome to the Nighthawks podcast, the cinema-centric podcast for people that like to... I did the bit.
You did the bit.
Oh no, this is a very cute little movie film here. I liked it a lot. It touched my heart.
Well, and I think it's really cool because it's not just cute and fun and funny. It's really smart. I think anytime you tip your hand into a story that involves physics like this, the inclination is to call it smart. But really, when we're talking about time travel and time loops, we are not getting into a deep discussion of relativity. We are not getting into a deep discussion of black holes, wormholes, superstring theory, any kind of actual scientific phenomenon. This is more of an H.G. Wells sci-fi story, not necessarily a Jules Verne sci-fi story, if that makes sense.
To be fair, you have to have a very high IQ to understand Rick and Morty. The humor is extremely subtle and without a solid grasp of theoretical physics, most of the joke. I'm just kidding.
No, Matt, he's a pickle.
I'm not going to do the whole thing. I'm not going to do the whole meme.
He's a pickle. He's doing it to avoid therapy. There you go. That's as smart as it got.
But I have a personal gripe about the notion of hard sci-fi, the notion that you take something like an Arthur C. Clarke or an Isaac Asimov, and the idea that, like, you know, something like, say, Dune is harder sci-fi because it's somehow more plausible than Star Wars. Like, they're both just space knights.
Yeah.
You know, this is a major gripe I have with, like, the Star Wars versus Star Trek conversation. With people that are, you know, either radically for or against films like Inception or Tenet, there's still a gimmick. The only hardness to the sci-fi, the only thing that makes it rigid, throbbing sci-fi as opposed to limp, floppy sci-fi, is consistency with the system as laid out in the movie, because it is still made up. Even in Alien, okay, yeah, it all looks like real mechanical stuff that a person could, in fact, build with a wrench and fly through space. That doesn't mean it is, like, if you pick it how far apart things are and how they must travel through space and time or whatever, like, it's still made up in order to be allegorical, right? What I like here is that the allegory you find yourself exploring is, like, what if you had a superpower that was kind of useless? What was one of Nicolas Cage's kind of most infamous ones is one where he can see, like, 30 seconds into the future, 2 seconds or something, just enough to, like, kind of duck a punch or, like, not be where a bullet is supposed to be. He can't squeeze enough utility out of it to, like, win the lottery or, you know. This is where this Drost effect comes in, because with the way this time travel loop happens, it's two devices that are connected. It's basically two smart TVs. I don't know what model they're supposed to be.
They're either TVs or computer monitors, but yeah, monitors of some kind.
And conveniently, the audio-visual features of them just work the whole time. Like, they never have any problem with their camera permissions. or giving Zoom access to the browser, which is the most farcical element of this science fiction to me. So yeah, there's a 2-minute time loop, and it's between the, like, karaoke monitor downstairs in a ramen shop and the owner's television upstairs. So there's just, like, a little 2-minute loop where he could, like, talk to himself and give himself, like, a real quick warning, like, don't come downstairs, the tax collectors are about to come. Oh shit, they're already here, never mind. Like, so. And he shows it to his friends, and they play with the novelty and whatnot and wherefore, and then eventually they come up with this way to, like,
expand how far they can see.
Yeah. Basically, they figure out that if they put the two monitors face to face, one of them will essentially become a copy of the other one in 2 minutes. And then every 2 minutes, it will happen again. And until they create an infinite corridor where each time they get another 2 minutes of time travel, but it increases the complexity of the sequence of events they have to reenact to pass information, basically playing the telephone game with themselves. So by the time they get to about, like, they're like, well, if we could get, like, 6 months out, we could do a stock tip or whatever. And then they realize, like, oh, that's a lot of work. We'd have to stay in this ramen shop, like, passing the stock tip forward every few minutes for 6 months. And
right.
And so they're like, okay, let's come up with a scheme that only takes an hour. Like, honestly, what makes this work really well is the chemistry. The friends group is just nice, you know? It's light. It's low stakes. It's... You know, they never expose themselves to a time Genghis Khan who comes through space and time to ruin the franchise with his real life behavior. That never happens in this. They never do any real, like, I'm doing anti-spoilers now. I'm talking about things that aren't in the movie. They never, nobody becomes their own grandpa or anything like that. The stakes are pretty low.
Well, and it's important to underline that it is not time travel. They're not going anywhere except... in the fact that we're all kind of time traveling all the time at 1 second per second. And this loop is, it's enough that he will sit in his room, he will have a conversation with himself 2 minutes in the future, which is just long enough for him to go downstairs, like 3 flights of stairs, sit in the cafe, and then have the other side of the conversation with himself from 2 minutes in the past. To me, the real star of this movie is the phenomenon. And it wouldn't be if it wasn't so tightly timed out, so well executed. Like I said, this is presented as one long shot. It's not. This was shot over several takes that are cobbled together to look like one long continuous shot. But it is timed out so specifically that if you start a stopwatch when he's having a conversation with himself in his bedroom, and then click the stopwatch when he goes downstairs to have that same conversation with himself from 2 minutes ago, it times out to 2 minutes. And that is exceedingly difficult to do. It requires a lot of discipline in filmmaking, a lot of discipline in directing, a lot of discipline in acting, a lot of discipline in editing, and making sure all those things fit together with no real visible cuts. I think I noticed a few on this watch through, but this is my second or third watch through, you know, and it's something that when I'm in the moment, when I'm observing this, when I'm trying to wrap my head around everything that's going on in it, to say that it lost me a couple of times is true, but it's also not a level of loss that takes me out of the movie. I'm still very invested, but it loses the characters every now and then, too. They realize, oh, no, we can't wait here for 6 months while we get ourselves the lottery numbers.
I'm trying to think how to put this. It's a very weird thing to have happened in the first place, and then the fun part is how quickly they roll with it. And they're almost sweet about it. Like they're not as malice focused as you would sort of think. I'm trying to think of a good way to describe it or a good thing to compare it to, but it's kind of like, I mean, it felt like a Twilight Zone or something that just didn't have the like stinging moral reveal at the end. It's like if an episode of The Outer Limits had a rom-com component instead of a horror component.
Well, and another thing I noticed, I mean, we're praising the performances here. We're praising the characters. But the characters are not especially well developed. We don't know. We have a protagonist. He has goals. We have supporting characters. They have characters. And they're not always just playing archetypes. But there is not a lot of time spent here going, oh, well, I'm a musician and I work in this cafe part-time and I'm really trying to make it. And would you like to come to my concert? And here's my best friend. He's kind of a smart aleck. Here's my other best friend.
He's kind of a doofus. He owns it. Several times they call him the owner.
That's right.
And that's why he's able to unlock it and lock it and stuff.
But from a perspective of, you know, how well developed these characters are in the writing, they're not especially well developed, but they are developed enough to carry you through the movie, to give it stakes. You are given just enough information about these people that you care about them. You admire the performances that are given. But as I said, for me, the star of this film is the actual premise and seeing it executed.
Well, I agree. This is what we're dealing with here is, on some level, this is almost like an elevated short. And I don't think it's underdeveloped. I think it's exactly developed enough. It keeps itself lean and functional. And there's no need to, like, it's okay that these characters are kind of like, you can tell one of them's kind of like the gamer friend. And one of them's kind of the friend with a real science job that explains the whole thing. And one of them's the coworker or employee there at the shop. And there's a little bit of implied, like, it sort of seems like the one guy maybe has a little bit of a crush on the waitress and some stuff like that. But they don't get into it. It's not the focus. This is just all kind of plot. It's barely an hour long. Like it's barely a feature, and it uses the entire screen time engagingly. It's just fun the whole time. I don't have a lot of complaints with the, you know, developmental quality of it, because I don't think it needed all those, because honestly it is about the main, you know, the main character, his kind of plot. And his kind of feelings about the future. That's what is amazing about this to me is, despite the fact that it's like, it's sort of gimmick reliant, it's sort of a bottle movie because it mostly happens literally in this one small cafe, and probably it looked like one real Japanese apartment, which means they're basically shooting, somebody was pressed up against the wall and then someone was acting in his lap, you know? So,
well, to talk a little bit, technically, everything I'm going to feel like an idiot saying this out loud, but everything I've read in about this has talked about the size of the camera as being comparable to a Tamagotchi, which, kids, if you're a millennial or a Gen Xer, you know exactly what I'm talking about. But they're a little keychain digital pet device. It's about the size of an AirPod container.
Well, if it isn't Tamagotchi, her new favorite pet.
Yes!
So what's that make me? Fish sticks?
Oh, are you hungry?
Oh, no, 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 no. By all means, feed it. Play till your heart's content.
Look, Goldie! I took good care of her, and she changed again.
Change? How about changing some water here?
Katie, Buzz is here.
So Tamagotchi can pause. I can pause too. Want to see that again?
Hatch a Tamagotchi, the one and only from Bandai, each sold separately.
And that's what we're talking about is the size. It's smaller than a pack of AA batteries. And they use
a Tamagotchi. Yeah. Was like a Flipper Zero, but you couldn't hack anything with it.
There you go.
just had the dolphin part.
Yeah, they just attached that to a cell phone, which they used as a monitor, and then they shot with that. Now, shooting the stuff that happens in the either monitor took approximately 2 to 3 days. Shooting the present narrative, the seemingly one long take that we follow as the audience, took about 4 days. So we're talking about a movie, a really tight movie that was shot in approximately 7 days. And this, as we mentioned, is a debut film for the director. He was a member of a theater troupe, and most of the actors here are members of that troupe as well. And it's interesting because during these interviews that I've heard with him, he talks about how he is actually kind of the junior member of this theater troupe. I might mispronounce this, but they're called the Europe Kikaku Theater Troupe. And out of everybody, he is the youngest. And so there was a little misgiving about whether or not he should be the one with the vision. They had talked about doing a movie for a long time, and it had never come to fruition. Finally, he's like, we've got this idea. Do you want to let me do this? And the cast didn't really wrap their heads around it on first blush. They read the script and didn't quite get it. And I can understand that. And so it was only through kind of proof of concept that he was able to get this done. And man, what a concept. Like, the logistics behind how to make this work, the amount of forethought you have to have before you even turn the camera on is incredible. It almost gave me a swimmy head just trying to wrap my head around the logistics of the behind the scenes of this movie. But sure enough, there it is. And man, it is just a tightly made, well-made, fun little movie. I will say, sometimes you're getting 2, 3, 4 sides of a conversation and you hear them 2, 3, 4 times. So it can be a little repetitive. I want to brace our audience for that. But really, I didn't care. I was actually taken enough with the story. I was taken enough with the concept. I was definitely taken with the filmmaking on display here. And so when things did get a little repetitive, I was still with the movie.
Yeah, I mean, I do think if this was 20 minutes longer, it would have probably overstayed its welcome. But it wasn't, so it didn't. I think everything really does look pretty good. And even some of there are a few like kind of core action scenes that happen. They have props that look pretty good. And the sense of the cafe as a place, it's photographed really well. It looks like they had to shoot a bunch of it at night. And yeah, they handled that well. It's well lit. It's well edited. It's just nice and competent and deserves some attention.
Well, and we enjoy mentioning late night cafes and coffee shops and things like that because that's kind of the aesthetic that we're trying to build as a podcast. This was shot over the course of that 7 days on location in Kyoto, Japan, at the cafe that all of these actors hang out at when they're not doing their theater troupe business. And so they could only shoot when the real cafe was not open. This is a very low-budget movie. It was produced for, at the time, 3 million Japanese yen. If we're talking about 3 million Japanese yen in 2023 dollars, that's about $20,000. I didn't have really the math or the gumption to figure out what it was worth in 2020, but it's going to be similar. They just kind of said, hey, can we shoot when you guys aren't open? And they did it. And that is something that I've certainly tried and can be a nightmare. You know, when you say, hey, I have a friend who owns a bar. Let's shoot a skit in there. Let's shoot a movie. Let's shoot a short. And you get there and, you know, they're perfectly happy to have you there until they realize, oh, no, we need to, like, close stuff down. We need to turn the jukebox off. We need to have lighting. We need to have this. And then the lighting falls over, and you have to replace a bulb. Well, nobody brought bulbs that day. We have to shoot again. It turns into a whole nightmare. And then on top of that, you have this movie that has such a precise need for direction, continuity, editing, and action. Like I said, it makes my head swim.
Yeah, I don't want to be all pretentious, and I also don't want to imply that I make more movies than I make. But it is hard to film in a real building. The reason for the set carpentry industry existing is not because, like, no one would let you film a Western in a real bar. It's because they want to be able to literally not have the fourth wall there. And, you know, and so as much as I love, like, you know, my episodes of No Reservations that happen in Japan.
Japanese cafe owner is not going to put up with a lot of nonsense.
Well, and we're large people. And I think I have an extra appreciation for how well they did just because of how claustrophobic the place looks to me. Like, oh, I don't want another stool that close to my stool. A person might sit on it.
Well, this kind of one-take filmmaking is an example of nagamawashi, which I do not know if I'm pronouncing right, but it's kind of a subgenre of mostly low-budget presented as one-shot Japanese films that have gained popularity because of the success of One Cut of the Dead, which more of our listeners have probably heard of. But that was back in 2017 and has spawned this kind of subgenre of these little, tiny, budget, long-take films.
Yeah, and it's not unknown. I don't want to call it a gimmick. It's not an unknown technique.
Convention, yeah.
There's been a few movies like it, but I think it works really well here. It keeps the unbroken looping, like it keeps your head in that, and it helps with the sense that the runtime is the runtime, like it's happening in real time, and that's really important to this movie making sense. Like this movie, the soap bubble would pop here if they were just like, oh well, I guess these two TVs are connected. Why don't we just throw box over it and we'll all go think about that. You know, the whole reason this works is it's one contiguous piece of whimsy. Like they're just sitting around. It's almost like something that happened on a drunken night out, except they don't particularly highlight that they're in any way drunk. It has that quality of like somebody's going to barge in and ruin it at any time.
Well, and there's even a moment like when they're playing with it and the people in the monitor who are 2 minutes in the future talking to the people in the prime timeline, they decide that they're going to throw tablecloths over their heads and hold candles and say, "We are you from the future. Ask us questions." And they're having fun with it. It's a LARF. It is a group of friends having a good time, and that good time for the audience, at least as far as I'm concerned, was infectious.
Or when they first build out the time tunnel and that prank they do there.
Yeah.
Hey everyone.
I'm Joe.
And I'm Trace.
And we're the Horror Queers.
Every week we do a deep dive into a different horror film and look at it through a queer lens.
This could mean pointing out queer creatives that worked on the film.
Or applying a queer reading to some of your favorite horror movie characters. Episodes can be serious and academic.
Or fun and frivolous.
It depends on the movie.
And no movie is off limits. The film could have explicit queer themes.
A high camp quotient.
Or both.
Or not at all.
We believe that representation matters, and since queer folks haven't always had the best representation,
we're here to help fix that.
So what are you waiting for? Subscribe today to start getting your weekly dose of queer horror.
Horror Queers, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Geeks, nerds, devotees of all worlds, lend me your ears. A community of inclusion and passion awaits you at oneofus.net. Movie and music reviews, debates on books and beer, deep dives into comics and games. There's something for everyone, because everyone loves something. Podcasts post daily, and with subscriptions you get video content as well. All are welcome, because in this world of fandom and fanaticism, all of us are in this together. Your love of pop culture and entertainment makes you one of us already. So join us today at oneofus.net.
So we did mention the pandemic, and that played a big role in this movie. Now, typically we're talking about the pandemic, and it's something that damn near killed the theatrical exhibition. It's ruined movies. It ruined box office. This is a pandemic success story. This movie was originally supposed to play in a small chain of small theaters to indie audiences,
And because we had so many movies that were delayed, were canceled, didn't make their premiere dates because of the pandemic, this movie actually ended up going to a lot of larger theaters where it got the exposure and became quite successful. And now it seems like in the small corners of the internet where I sometimes lurk, this movie is catching a lot of attention as being very good and is highly recommended from most of the... Like, I have not seen a bad word said about this movie. Everybody finds something to enjoy.
You'd have to be kind of heartless.
It does have a lot of heart. It's very sweet. So, I don't know, Matt. Like, it seems like all the pieces fit here. The characters are fun. The script is well written. The funny moments are funny. The suspenseful moments are suspenseful. And folks, it's not too much of a spoiler to say that this all goes unexpectedly awry at one point. And things start to happen that we weren't expecting. The way that they're able to send information down the line, we're not really sure what's happening up the line from there. And that invites a lot of unknown variables. And so there's a story here, there's suspense here, but it's just all well executed, and it's good filmmaking, and it's entertaining to watch. And that is a combination for a movie that just cannot be beat. But with that being said, I do have a few small criticisms. However, they are story-specific criticisms that we'll have to save for beyond the spoiler curtain. So Matt, do you have any final thoughts for our folks who are then going to turn the podcast off, go watch this movie for free if you want, currently streaming as of this record on Tubi, I think on Freevee. I think it's part of the Amazon Prime package. Like, choose your own adventure on how you're going to watch this. But what are your final thoughts before we start talking about plot-specific criticisms?
I don't have a lot of criticisms that fall outside the spoiler.
All right, I will say I highly recommend this movie. We're doing it on this episode tonight because we want to bring attention to it. We would love if our listeners were able to check this out, get this watched, fall in love with it themselves. So it's a high recommend from me. Matt, it sounds like a recommend from you.
Definite recommend.
All right, well, folks, I think that's going to bring us to our spoiler curtain. Matt, why don't you take that monitor? Yeah, that monitor there. And face it towards my laptop monitor. Let me get out of the way here. And now we have the Drost effect. They can see each other down the timeline. Now ask Matt in 2 minutes. No, that's too long. That's too long. I can't wait 2 minutes for you to hit the button. Why don't you hit the button now? Hey, Matt, in 2 minutes. Tell Matt now to hit the button.
I'm just going to hold up the kitty and make an infinite kitty.
Oh, they didn't make Infinite Kitty. That is money on the table. They missed an opportunity there.
And now I shall hit the button.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Nighthawks Podcast. I am your host, Trevor T. Trujillo, and with me in the cafe, as always, I did the bit again. See, it works because not only did we do the bit, but we did the bit is doing it again, and then we did the bit again. Do you get it?
I think I get it.
I think I get it. I think I get this movie. I think I get it.
I have to admit, I backed up the middle where they explained the tunnel and watched it twice.
Yeah. It is a lot of Japanese, it is a lot of reading, and it all happens very quickly. So there were a few times where I did watch a scene a couple of times. But I also, I had fun. It didn't take me out of the movie. I was more engaged while I was doing that.
And you asked if I had any story criticisms that were outside the spoiler, and I didn't. I do have one, which is that, like, so obviously, of course, they immediately put themselves into figuring out, like, how to make a little money this way. And they end up hearing from their future selves that they find a VCR full of money, like an old VCR with a you know, bundle of bills stashed in it. That device is necessary to have the second act, basically, because the owner of the money wants it back. But it's like the weakest plot point here is how they go and find that money. like them from the future has to tell them that they found it, but it also like isn't very likely, you know. But I'm willing to overlook that.
Well, and there's a couple of things like that though, like where the people in the future are giving advice to people in the past, but the people in the past, as they become the people of the future, are paranoid about disrupting the timeline.
And there's even the one where he's supposed to ask the girl out.
Yeah, Kato, he's supposed to ask the girl out, and he says, go ask her out. She says yes. And so he goes and asks her out, and she says no. And so he comes back dejected, but he does not want to disrupt the space-time continuum, so he enthusiastically reports to him from 2 minutes ago to go ask her because she says yes. And so that is really our conflict here. It's not the guys looking for their money. It's not the people trying to figure out the phenomenon. It's this guy wrestling with, am I being dictated what my future is supposed to be by listening to a guy who really doesn't know much more than I do? And so the reason they know where to pick up the money is because the people from two minutes from now say, go get this money. And the reason the people 2 minutes in the future knew to go get the money was because people 2 minutes ahead of them told them to go get it 2 minutes ago. I know that's very confusing coming out of my mouth. I didn't say it very well. But it is one of those cyclical things where, would any of this be happening if we weren't paying attention, if we weren't listening, if we weren't adhering to the space-time continuum? And we get a little answer about that. There are some time police in play here. And that's my criticism, is that the time police arc seems fairly unnecessary. It's not super well explained and is probably the most soft science fiction of this story, is they kind of blow off the whole phenomenon as, it's a wormhole thing. It's rare, but it happens. But anyways, we're here to fix it. No further explanation given. We know what's up, and we need you to make things right. And so that was a little, like, I think there is probably a movie to be had in a group of time cops, maybe. But this was not that movie. I'm not particularly upset that they didn't explore that more, but it is something where I'm like, huh, they kind of came and went and didn't have a lot of impact on the story, except that it's ultimately his conflict with them that gets him to break the loop.
Well, that, and you could have tightened it up and like written them as like a, that could have been like older them from the future or something like that. That would have taken an effect, you know? But the time cops seem remarkably low stakes for what they're supposed to be, you know? I think, you know, the guys that show up looking for the missing money from their dead drop are hardened, you know, they're Yakuza criminals, and they have to kind of Groundhog Day their way through defeating the people that would otherwise easily stab them. And that's all brought off very, very, you know, there's good physical comedy there. You know, he stabs him, and no, he stabbed a ketchup bottle, and he shoots him, and no, he shot the cylinder head from his drum set, stuff like that, you know. That's all a hoot. But then it kind of gets into the ending, which is that the whole time the main character has been really surly about using this time power. And I actually thought he was going to turn out to know something about the cause the first time I watched this. Like, I thought he was going to be connected to the time cops or be from another time or something. And this was a side effect of him coming to our present. But they don't burden the movie with that. They just have him be someone who had like a grim mindset. And they discuss how he's like constantly aware that like bars for the apocalypse are being set and missed.
I will say, ultimately, I was a sucker for this because I love a movie that has a cinematography gimmick like this. A couple of examples, Escape from Tomorrow, the movie that our friend Lucas Lee Graham was cinematographer on, where they shot entirely undercover at Disneyland. That's not one long take. That's not a time loop movie. But it is, you've got to deploy some clever cinematography there. So part of the joy of watching that film is figuring out how did they do that. Gravity was another one with fantastic cinematography where you sit there and scratch your head going, I can't quite wrap my head around how that shot was achieved. You have other long take movies, Too Late,
Victoria come to mind. Both of those Fantastic Fest movies that both you and I saw. I just like these gimmicky filmmaking movies, but you don't have to appreciate it on that level. If you're not a filmo, if you're not somebody who's sitting there picking apart how beautiful Roger Deakins' cinematography is in 1917, you can still enjoy this movie on just the superficial script level of this is a fun, good story. But there is a lot here to unpack from a filmmaking perspective. And I really enjoy that. The fact that it is so strong in both avenues is really remarkable, especially for a plucky little movie done by a theater troupe in Kyoto, Japan. Like, way to go, guys.
Yeah, I mean, this is just something I really like to see more eyes on. I had a lot of fun watching it every time I watched it. I think it just holds together really nicely. It lands on its feet at the end. And I just can't think of a single real complaint with it, you know?
Here's one. I will say that the ending and the climax in this is really fantastic because it's when they're really deploying how to use the time travel well. And our protagonist is carrying the 2 minutes ago monitor up the stairs as he's going to save this girl while the people downstairs are watching it and they know what is going to be coming. So they give him the tools that he needs as he needs them to defeat these Yakuza guys because they know what's going to happen. It happened 2 minutes ago on screen for them. And so it's this really deft, here, you know, you said it yourself. Here's the ketchup bottle. Here's the symbol from the drum set. Here's a rolled up plastic pill bug that a guy got as a reward, as a very rare chase figure when he was playing with the Drost effect. But the climax of this movie really is kind of a princess save. That, I guess, is a small criticism. The cafe owner has this crush on a girl who works next door. She gets wrapped up in this as an kind of unwitting member and falls prey to some of these darker characters. And he has to go in and take care of business and save her. And the ultimate resolution to that is that the girl is a little more inclined to go see this guy's show. And maybe a blossoming relationship forms from that. That's pretty tropey. That's pretty old hat. But again, at the same time, watching this movie, I'm not watching it for the super complex interpersonal stories. I'm watching it for this cool concept. So, yeah, it's a princess save. Yes, that's a legitimate criticism. For me, it didn't take anything away from the movie.
I think the way it gets away with it a little bit is because the experience is a catalyst for them, like, really sitting down and opening up and talking. And, you know, the denouement, as it were here, is they sit down and talk by themselves after everyone else is gone. That scene felt so plausible and real. I think it would have fallen more into the sort of yucky version of the trope if she'd have, like, you know, fallen into his arms and kissed him, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, but, good point.
But the scene felt like something that was kind of naturally happening between two grown-ups. So it didn't leave a very bad taste in my mouth.
I will say I wasn't 100% sure why creating a time paradox caused the time cops to just, like, vanish. I think I get it in principle. I don't think it was textually explained very well, but once again, we're talking about the last 2 minutes of the movie, and by the time I got there, I really wasn't holding it to a particular bar on that level.
You'd almost have to ask the filmmaker, but I felt like the intended interpretation is that they don't need to be there anymore because he voluntarily, like, he shuts it off and never uses it again.
Yeah. But it is what it is. And like I said, one of my other criticisms was that it can get repetitive in places, but it's setting something up. When it's repetitive in the beginning, they use that convention that you are now familiar with it being repetitive, to kind of foreshadow other things that are going to happen later. So as we get the Drost effect going, we see the Yakuza kind of approaching this girl with a knife way down the line. And then a little bit later, it's coming closer. And a little bit later, it's coming closer. And as it's coming closer down the line, you realize that this is about to happen. And even though it is a repetitive moment when it happens, it is paying something off that they have set up. And so it feels more satisfying than it does repetitive.
Well, yeah. And like, that actually brings up a good point, is that there, everything in this is Chekhovian. Almost everything introduced is used in the plot. Like you said, the pill bug that he gets out of the vending machine they use to scare the guy that's afraid of bugs later, and that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It almost has a weird feel like they're solving an escape room.
Actually, you know what it kind of reminded me of? And we just talked about this. Go check our last episode, which I should say, go check our previous episode, which is the episode on Poltergeist. This really felt like those moments where the ghost hunters were like, oh, there's a portal to another realm in your kid's room. Let's throw a tennis ball through and see where it comes out. And kind of that investigative, informal, it's science, but it's amateur, and we're really figuring this out for ourselves, not for, repeatable scientific reasons. There was a lot of that shot through here, and that was a fun part of Poltergeist, and it's a really fun part of this movie.
Yeah, yeah. The sense of happiness they have when they discover a weird phenomenon.
Right.
And how only the main character is the gloomy Gus about it, and everybody else is like, oh, this is a hoot. We got time travel, and you can use it for pranks.
Well, Matt, I always hate when our episodes run longer than the movies we watch, so I want to keep this episode pretty brisk. But I think a conversation worth having is our trademark if-then section. So I've got a couple, and I know you have a couple as well. Do you want to kick us off with one?
I think we kind of independently arrived at a very similar list, but one I had is the time travel movie Primer.
Which, I might add, before you go on, is something that the director of this film, Beyond the Infinite 2 Minutes, has cited as being a very big influence on this. Matt, deep dark confession, I've never seen Primer. Which will get me crucified in certain circles, but...
You're talking about making a bigger one. You're talking about making a bigger one.
Primer is basically this movie if it wasn't funny. Because Primer is like it's sort of about these two Steve Jobsian inventors, and they discover a little way to make a time loop, but their time loop revolves around, I forget the exact nature of the conceit, but you have to put yourself in like a sensory deprivation tank for a given amount of time, and then go through the time loop to avoid any chance of paradox. So you have to immobilize yourself and not take any actions, and then you can go back, and then you can time travel for that amount of time. And so to use the looping device, you have to inconvenience yourself in the prime timeline, and then they sort of discover that the more they do it, there's eventually kind of a degenerative consequence. And they have to deal with the temptation to do it to advance their careers and advance their lives versus the bad effects it's having on them in the world. Like I said, it's kind of like this, except it's played much straighter and not funny. It was made on something like a sub $10,000 budget. And it's the first, I think it was the first Shane Carruth movie. And he was the guy that went on to do Upstream Color.
Well, my first if then, also a movie on the dangers of time loops, I'm going to evoke one of our patron saints, Spanish filmmakers. We have Nacho Vigalondo's Time Crimes. This is not one that is presented in one long take, but it is something that
has a very cyclical story, and it's about closing those loops in a time loop, and when you're observing them from a prime timeline, things don't necessarily make sense, but as you go along, finding out who is that mysterious figure that was watching you from around the corner when you're able to see them further down the timeline. You know, why is this seemingly unrelated person suddenly involved in this story? Why are people getting hurt? And finding out the answers to those and knowing that in order to make things right, you have to do some of this shit. It's a really clever, interesting way. And Nacho Vigalondo as a filmmaker is just, he selects projects and he writes projects that are very clever, very original. And so there's a lot of overlap here for me where it just smacks of, hey, this is a really cool concept and a really interesting story told around that concept. And at the end of the day, it was tight. I didn't have many questions. I wasn't left scratching my head. It was not, what's a movie that had me just turn around in the parking lot and go, hey, wait, Avatar, there's one. It's like, you know, you're walking through the parking lot going, hey, that was pretty cool. Wait, no, that was Fern Gully. That was Fern Gully with a little soupçon of Dances with Wolves. Wait a minute, what did I just watch? Why was the end scene just like Aliens? Wait a minute, is Jim Cameron ripping himself? Is this The Abyss? Are we watching Aliens again? Like, none of that happened with these movies, and Time Crimes is another example of that. We also very much love Nacho Vigalondo as a person. He's somebody we've had the opportunity to meet and tip many a beer with. He's a wonderful person, a wonderful filmmaker. For a long time, he was basically the mascot of Fantastic Fest. So I wanted to throw some specific love to Time Crimes. I will say we came real close to selecting Time Crimes for this episode. And eventually, we will have a Nacho Vigalondo movie on this show. It just wasn't today. Now, Matt, this next one you have lined up is one I'm not familiar with.
This is a movie called Kidnapped, and it's from 2010, since there are many, many things called Kidnapped.
Dios! Un móvil. No dejéis entrar a nadie hasta que llegue la policía. ¿Me escuchas? No.
Papá, ¿qué hacen aquí?
¿Hola?
¿Qué has comprado, champán?
Esta noche hay que celebrar, ya te lo he dicho. No podemos cenar una noche, aunque sea la primera, los tres juntos.
Esto en verano va a molar, ¿eh?
Si estás tranquilos, tus chicas están bien. Si no, se mueren.
Por favor, no quiero verle la cara.
Vamos a ir fuera. No voy a salir con la capucha en la cabeza.
Vete, vamos.
Dale. Saca las tarjetas de crédito y apunta los números.
¡Nos van a matar!
¡No nos van a matar, Lisa! ¡No nos van a matar, papá!
Kidnapped is a, you know, a home invasion piece in the vein of You're Next or something like that. But it's shot with the low takes conceit. Are actually some cuts in it, but they're cuts in black. The point of view character is shut in a closet or something, so they cut on that black. Kind of a nasty home invasion movie. It came out around the same time as like high tension in French. Tension. Lay high tension, the tensions that is high. And it was kind of there was a little wave of those, and doesn't particularly have any big names attached to it. And it was it's Spanish. It's kind of released in Europe and then made its way out on video. Didn't make a big splash. You know, it's kind of a hard R home invasion movie. It's some ugly stuff happens in it by the nature of the source material, you know, but it is really stylistic. It really has a pretty tight grip on the gimmick. It gets left off of these lists a lot of the time just because I think just because it's, you know, subtitled and kind of ugly. So, well, I thought I would just pipe up and mention it.
Well, and I think the prototypical example that's going to come to any film fan's head is Alfred Hitchcock's Rope. right? This is Hitchcock telling a movie on 35mm film. A reel of 35mm film only lasts, I think it's 23 minutes or 26 minutes, something in there. And he presented Rope as one long feature-length shot that he hid all of the edits in. Like you mentioned, character gets shut in the closet, it's dark. They use that black to add in an edit. They open the door, it looks like one continuous shot. Hitchcock did that all through Rope. You know, sometimes a guy walks in front of a camera and they wipe, or they pan, or they zoom into his back and it creates a black screen where they can cut there. And I think the rest of mine all kind of operate somewhere on that spectrum, because I really leaned into the trope here. One of the ones I wanted to mention is Dennis Houck's Too Late.
Dorothy called me 3 days ago asking for help.
What do you do for a living?
I'm a private investigator.
Have you heard from Dorothy recently?
I just think I saw something I shouldn't have.
How did you expect to arrest me without a gun?
If I have a gun, I'm gonna kill him. I'm trying hard not to do that.
You wanna back me up for old time's sake?
I feel so violent.
Then let's set it to music.
This is one that was several long takes. Like I said, a reel of 35 millimeter film takes about 20 minutes. This is not one long continuous shot for a feature-length film. This is 3, 4, maybe 5 vignettes that are all 23 minutes, that are all one long take, that are all shot on one reel of 35 millimeter film. And then those segments of this story are then shown out of order, kind of Pulp Fiction style. And what you get is this really neat private eye drama that stars John Hawks. Really fantastic movie, hard-bitten private eye, right in my lane. And it also has this neat cinematography gimmick. It's one of those things, though, where when they were shooting it, I think back in 2008, it wasn't really a choice. It wasn't really a thing to shoot on 35mm film. It's just what you made movies out of. But by the time they got it all shot, it was a low-budget, independent film. By the time they got it all done, edited, and put out on the festival circuit, everything else was being shot digitally. And so they kind of made the marketing choice where it's like, well, we shot this on 35. The convention is, because it is 35mm film that comes in 23-minute segments, we're only going to feature this movie in theaters that will show it on 35mm. It has since, of course, been ported over to streaming, which completely removes that from the table. But I will say, when Matt and I watched it, it was on 35mm film, and I think this is one of those occasions where watching it in the theater with a crowd on 35mm film, with the cigarette burns signaling the real changes and things, really added a little spice to this movie, but I think it did cost it some invisibility.
Yeah, and I think this was, if I remember correctly, Too Late took a long time to make and was kind of a passion project. It's a really strange movie. It feels like something from like the exploitation era, where it feels like an adaption of a detective novel that nobody cleaned up for network TV. Because the actual, you know, a lot of the actual, like, Mike Hammer novels and stuff are a little grittier than the versions of them they produced for television. Too Late is definitely that. It has a scene of prolonged, aggressive bottomlessness. It has John Hawks punching a lot of people.
Yeah, that's always fun.
It's a weird-ass movie, but it's good. I recommend it to a lot of people.
I also wanted to, and I think this even played Fantastic Fest the same year as Too Late, but I wanted to throw a shout-out to Victoria, which is a movie that came out of Germany that still, for the most part, at least as far as the marketing and the interviews are concerned, is being sold as the real deal of what all of this other stuff is claiming to do. Now, Beyond the Infinite 2 Minutes is presented as one long continuous shot. It is not. What the people who made Victoria posit is that what you are watching with Victoria is one long continuous shot that takes you from the very tip-top rooftops above this German city to the very bottom parking garages and subterranean areas, out into the courtyards and into the streets, and represents a really long, very disciplined take. And you are getting that one long, continuous take. They basically, here's our actors, our set is this series of city blocks. We're going to walk them through the entire movie in real time, and what you see on camera is what we captured on camera.
We have to do something. Please, can you help us?
Okay.
Yeah?
No problem. I'm the big driver.
Yeah.
What's happening?
Deine Privatbank. Limburgen Chor. Wir wissen, dass in dem kleinen Tresor 50.000 Euro liegen. Und die will ich haben. Du schuldest mir was. Mach nicht. Hey.
Hey.
Hey, hey, hey.
Hey, wir machen safe. Hey, wir machen schon.
Now, I have talked to some people who claim that they can see the seams in Victoria. They say they can see cuts. They can see edits. I didn't see that when I watched the movie, and I think I've seen it twice now. And it is, again, one of those things that by the time Victoria is over, I'm really not watching it on that level anymore because it does have a compelling story. But this is one of the ones that is really claiming to have done what all these other ones are trying to look like they did, which is just show this, shoot it, show it, act it, all in real time. And so,
bop it.
Bop it, twist it, pass it.
I liked Victoria when I watched it. I didn't have a lot of I don't remember one mind blowing scene or anything, but I retained favorable emotional impressions of Victoria. I might be a little bit of a Victoria truther.
Yeah, you think there's some edits in there?
Because it just didn't seem, and it not the action parts, believe it or not, because I believe that they did their best 2 out of 3 on there. But
literally
the just dialogue and stuff, the dialogue just didn't seem rough enough.
Yeah.
To have been one long take, you know.
The story behind Victoria, whether you believe it or not, but this is the story that's being promulgated. The financiers got real cold feet over this single take thing and said, shoot a version that's edited. And they did. And the director said, it's terrible. And they only gave him a budget to do 3 takes on the long version. And what we're getting is take number 3, was their final attempt. Well, I'm not sure if edits exist. If they did, they went by me. A lot of people claim they see them. I don't know. But the result is a pretty impressive movie nonetheless, and a pretty good noirish crime yarn.
I think one valid criticism of Victoria, that it's very similar to, I think probably the last one I'd pitch, which is Run Lola Run. I don't think crew of Run Lola Run would have you believe that it was, you know, truly shot in one take or anything, but it reminded me a lot of, obviously, plot is not a copyrightable plot. Young woman on the party scene gets herself in trouble over a drug deal. It's this plot of Go. It's the plot of, you know.
Yeah.
It's not like it's something you could truly say there was a ripoff there. And they are tonally different. They don't really feel that different. They don't really feel that similar. But there's a strong elevator pitch resemblance between the two of them.
Now, my last two are two movies that we have talked about a bit before with our Oscar czar Cameron Maris. Because both of these movies got significant Oscar buzz and some significant Oscar wins. I did want to mention 1917, which is the Oscar-winning, Oscar-nominated World War I movie. That one is told in real time. It is presented as, I believe, they'll concede that it's presented as 2 long shots in 2 long takes. It is not. Roger Deakins worked on this. The legendary cinematographer, often passed over for Oscars, finally won. And they were able to take these several long shots and then cobble them together to make them look like one long take. But the story is presented in real time. The story happening on screen is a 2 hour and a minute story, and it takes 2 hours and minutes to show you on screen. And then my other example is Birdman, or The Unexpected Virtue of Ignorance, which is cobbled together from several long takes to look like one long take, but is not presented in real time. That is a story that unfolds over the course of several days, I think even several weeks, if not months.
How did we end up here? This place is horrible. Smells like balls. We had it all. You were a movie star, remember?
Who was this guy?
He used to be Birdman.
I like that poster.
You wrote this adaptation?
I did, yeah.
And you're directing and starring in your adaptation. That's ambitious.
Are you afraid people will say you're doing this play to battle the impression that you're a washed-up comic strip character?
Absolutely not. That's why 20 years ago I said no to Birdman 4.
Hold the mask off!
You do hold the mask off!
Now you're about to destroy what's left of your career. We should have done that reality show they offered us.
Shut up.
Oh, ow! I'm gonna grab up on your ass, fucking choke you out.
Don't. You know I'm right.
You're so nice!
Hey, what's up? Why don't you try to rest a little bit?
Face it, Dad. You're doing this because you're scared to death, like the rest of us, that you don't matter. And you know what? You're right. You don't.
Baby, can you understand?
They use transitions like you might see in a stage show, where they pan up and we get a beautiful shot of the skyline, and then they pan back into the room and it's several days later. Or just in the wipe from the makeup mirror to the door, we'll have Michael Keaton, who's the star of that movie, who does incredible things in that movie. He walks off screen right. And then when we pan to the door, he walks in the door, and we take that as a time transition to mean that we're in a different time, same place. And it's almost like watching a stage show, where instead of turning the lights off and having a bunch of people dressed in black run out and rearrange the set real quick, we just take the audience's point of view and shove it at a skyline, or at a flower, or at a piece of scenery. And then when we turn back, the set is different, or new, or something has changed. And so it feels a little more like a stage play, but it is, once again, one story in one seemingly long, fluid take.
Well, and the thing that gets me about Birdman is it was like they made their own lives really hard, because the events, the locations these events happen in are places like Times Square, backstage area filled with vanity mirrors. You know, and it's not a movie that you'd think of as an effects movie, but just the removal or shooting around of reflections alone in it, I don't envy whoever had to do it.
So Matt, I guess my ultimate question here to kind of close out the podcast is, why Beyond the Infinite 2 minutes? Where does it excel that we talk about it in hushed tones with things like Birdman, Primer, Kidnapped, 1917, Too Late? Like, what is this bringing to the table?
It's the aspect of, like, magical realism that gets me, right? This is a very much like this is like a movie where it has that quality of, like it feels like something from, like, a book of Neil Gaiman stories or something like that. Like it has a fable quality that I really liked. And it also feels like it has this sort of dream loop quality where you're like, oh, this is happening, but it's probably not really the routine conventions of this world. And you don't get the impression that these guys are going to, like, time travel all the time or time loop all the time. Or, you know, it's a kind of a one enchanted evening thing. I like that vibe. Like, oh, here's this guy that was in a rut and he got a little nudge from the universe. You know, oh God, am I personalizing it?
If you weren't, you just did. I will say, I'm noticing, out of the long list of if-thens, none of the ones we mentioned were comedies. Now, we could mention One Cut of the Dead, but once again, big secret, I haven't seen One Cut of the Dead. I haven't seen it. I'm sorry. I own a copy. I never managed to get it watched. And that one has some funny aspects, but that's a zombie movie. It's a horror film. I think it's really fun to see a very serious, very disciplined take that is not treated like Too Late is a dark movie. Time Crimes is a dark movie. Rope is a dark movie. Victoria is a dark movie. Birdman's a really dark movie. 1917 is a really heavy movie. This one is effervescent. It's fun. It's something you want to pop in at a party and show to people and share. I would love to share Birdman with the world, but they're not going to have as much fun with it.
It is a pill for the world that gives Birdman to ex-girlfriends. You people just don't get it.
But Beyond the Infinite 2 minutes is definitely the most fun out of this long list that we've given you. If you're planning on a double feature, make sure that you're watching Beyond the Infinite 2 minutes last, because it is definitely the aperitif that's going to leave you feeling better than any of the other ones we mentioned. All right, Matt. Well, that's our conversation on Beyond the Infinite 2 minutes. Do you have any final thoughts before we really wrap things up?
What kind of time travel song could we close out on?
Oh man, I don't know.
All right, I guess I'm just going to take a step to the left and say we better sign off because it's almost morning.
Just a jump to the left.
And then a step to the right.
With your hands on your hips.
Oh, yours is better than mine, that's for sure.
What was yours going to be? You go.
Well, I was going to do Huey Lewis and the News Back in Time, which was used in a time travel movie. It was the title track for Back to the Future, but...
Well, would you say that time is on our side here? Before we decide which one to pick?
Well done. You're on fire tonight.
Well, you know, I get better at this as time goes by.
All right. All right, cut.
You must remember this. A kiss is still a kiss. A sigh is just a sigh. The fundamental things apply as time goes by.